Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Breaking news from the New York Times. Facebook has just announced that they have suffered some kind of attack on their computer network, and the personal information of 50 million users has been exposed. So I guess here's my first question related to that. If you have a Facebook page, which I do, so I'll just lump myself into this category, we're already exposed. Like, that's kind of the nature of it. And so we may not want our personal information exposed beyond the way we have set up our Facebook page to limit that exposure. But the reality is we're on Facebook as a free-to-use platform, and pretty much anything we post on there, we better be prepared to have made public broadly. So anyway, that'll just be my first little, I don't know, connecting faith to life reality right here. Okay, so I'm gonna do today what everybody else is doing today, which is give you some feedback and reflection, and hopefully some conversational talking points about the Kavanaugh Ford drama yesterday, and then the drama at the Senate confirmation. The meeting that happened earlier today of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then to tell you that in 25 minutes, they're going to take a vote. And I'll predict that in the middle of the show, Brett Kavanaugh's nomination will be forwarded from the committee onto the full Senate. And that sometime in the next 48 hours, the full Senate will actually take a vote. And he will be confirmed as the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm just going ahead and telling you in advance what I anticipate is going to happen. Even though there are now lots of folks in the court of public opinion who do not see that as an appropriate way forward. So here are some observations about yesterday. First of all, those of you who sort of know what happened and how it happened, Christine Blasey Ford came before the committee first. And so you heard basically the prosecution. If you were thinking about a court of law, you were hearing the prosecution's witness first, and then they took a break. And so during that break, you got all kinds of commentary and all kinds of people saying, well, my mind is now made up because they found her to be, quote unquote, credible. Let me go ahead and tell you, I actually found both Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh to be credible. And when I use the term credible, I am saying I can see how people could choose to believe either one of them. They tell believable stories. And I'm going to use the word stories because we don't have any corroborating evidence. We don't have any corroborating witnesses. And it's impossible to prove dispositively. This would be on Brett Kavanaugh's behalf here. You cannot prove that you weren't somewhere that hasn't been identified at some time that also has not been identified. Like, it's impossible to prove that. I can't prove to you that I was not in a place somewhere at some time that you can't tell me where and when. So this is part of the challenge that we face in this conversation. They actually both seem to be telling the truth, which obviously can't be true if truth is that which accords with reality, which is, by the way, the definition of truth. So the question for Christians in conversations today is going to have to be about the truth and whether or not the truth matters. Now, for Christians, the truth matters, and it matters ultimately. And we know the truth, and we have been set free by the one who is the way and the truth and the life. But we're not having conversations in the culture that are based on that understanding of truth in terms of what's revealed to us in the Bible and who Jesus is. Like, that's not the conversation the culture is having. The culture is having a conversation that changed during the Enlightenment to be what you and I would describe as evidence-based. And so people are looking for empirical evidence to back up the stories. And that's why you hear lots of calls for, quote-unquote, investigation. Because what they're looking for is empirical, either corroborating or exculpatory evidence. Here's the challenge. If there is no corroborating nor exculpatory evidence, you are left with two people's stories. And the reality is, you and I are each, and everyone else, is choosing to believe, at this point, one story or the other. We can describe both people as credible in that they are telling stories that could possibly be true, which means that there are some people who are choosing to believe one person's story, other people who are choosing to believe the other person's story, because the story lines up with a larger narrative or larger set of ideas, a worldview. So there's a really big question for me as to whether or not what the Senate committee yesterday was even seeking, or some people on it, were even seeking to discover what I would describe as the actual truth. If you had been looking for the actual truth, you had time, if you are on the Democratic side of this conversation, you had time to involve law enforcement or the FBI in investigating these claims as early as July. But that's not what happened, and I would say that the answer as to why that didn't happen is both politics and timing. Now, I would say it's absolutely impossible for us to imagine how all of these people's lives, and when I say all of these people, because the circle of complexity goes way beyond the individuals whose names are Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. They each have spouses. They each have families. They each have parents. They have friends. They have colleagues and coworkers. There are concentric waves and circles of people who have been wounded and damaged and in some cases ruined through this process. That is not to the credit of America nor our system. So it seems to me that this particular kind of truth-telling set no one free yesterday. And if you and I know that the truth is what sets us free, then we have to look at what happened yesterday and say, this process, this kind of truth-telling, this does not set people free. I would say that it was not a good day for the American version of constitutional democracy. If our form of government is potentially one of our greatest exports as a country, then yesterday was certainly not a good marketing piece. There is a process which still lies ahead. There still is a vacancy on the Supreme Court to be filled. The court convenes Monday, October the 1st. And so I would expect a very accelerated process between now and then. Prayers for that, prayers for these two families, prayers for these two parties, prayers for every senator who right now is being pressed hard on every side, particularly the four who are seen as the swing votes, prayers for Brett Kavanaugh's kids, prayers for his wife, on and on and on. If we're going to be called to something, let's be people that are called in these days to prayer. Now, let me say this. I think that I just make this final observation about this. We are living in what I will describe as the mean times. This isn't just the mean time, like some time in between. It is the time in between Jesus' first advent and his second advent. Jesus is, by the way, in case this is news to you, coming again to judge both the living and the dead. And we do live in that in-between time, the both the now and the not yet in terms of the kingdom here. We live in between those two advents. And so this is the meantime in that sense. But this is the meantime in terms of it just being mean. It's mean. Sometimes the mean times are mean. Paul reminds us in 2 Timothy 3 that the days in which we live are going to be evil. He says, for people will be lovers of self and reckless and heartless and brutal and ungrateful and without self-control and lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. 1 Peter 4 also tells us not to be surprised by suffering that comes because of our faith. So Christians, you know, frankly, we can expect to be mistreated, but it ought not happen on such a public stage in such very mean-spirited ways. So friends, you and I live in the mean times, but we do so as lovers of God. And so let's you and I live in the meantime with eternity in mind. And let's live good and godly lives, even in the midst of these very mean times. Okay, there's a headline out of Houston that I want to discuss today, and it's kind of an icky headline. I'll just tell you in advance. And so joining me to discuss this particular headline about sex robot brothels is Dr. Nancy Piercy. Now, Nancy Piercy is a professor at Houston Baptist University. She's the author of Love Thy Body, Answering the Hard Questions about Life and Sexuality. She's going to join me right after the break to discuss the disturbing news that sex robot brothels are on their way to America. One is set to open just next month in Houston's Galleria Business District. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Yes, you heard me right. And you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'll be right back.
You're a good, good father. It's who you are. It's who you are.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Indeed, he is a good, good father. And he gives us, by grace, a knowledge of goodness and beauty and truth. But we also live in the reality of fallenness. And so here to talk with me about, well, I would just say a current expression of the depth of our depravity is Dr. Nancy Piercy. She is the professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. You can follow her on Twitter at Nancy R. Piercy. Nancy, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I'm just going to give a two-sentence summary of the headline or of the news headline, and then you can run with it from there as a wow, because Houston is your town, and I know that you're working on this particular issue. So here for our audience is what we're talking about. The founder of Kinky S Dolls is going to open the first sex robot brothel in the United States sometime in early October in Houston. He does not call this a brothel. He prefers the term showroom. So tell us what he means by the term showroom and tell us how people are responding.
Right. So the founder of this sex brothel, he's very honest about it. He says, I talked to a lawyer, and the lawyer told me, if you're smart, you won't call it a brothel. You'll find another word for it. So he calls it a showroom. And what he means is that it operates like a car showroom. In other words, people can rent the dolls, test them on the premises, and decide whether to buy one. So if you want half an hour in a private room with a sex robot, you pay $60, and I think you can get up to 2 hours. So it's really a way around the law. By not calling it a brothel, he's making it harder for cities to regulate. Now, the Houston mayor is going to try to regulate it. He said in an email statement, the city is looking to upgrade our ordinances to cover this type of business. The city council is actually due to vote on these amendments next Wednesday because, of course, the laws were written before there were such things as sex robots. And so in order to meet the new technology, they're rewriting some of their city ordinances to see if they can figure out a way to regulate them. Right now, they don't think they can outlaw them. They think they can merely regulate them as a sexually oriented business is what it's called, SOB. And sexually oriented businesses do have certain regulations. They have to be a certain distance from schools, daycare centers, churches, and so on. So they're looking into those kinds of regulations.
Okay, so I know my listeners are now particularly disturbed because one of the realities is this is a franchise, and he's just opening the first one, and the projections are that this could actually replace porn, which we know is a huge industry. Talk with us about the whole concept of depersonalizing sex, because that's what this feels like. This feels like we're moving from, you know, sex being one thing that we would be able to understand and describe from a biblical narrative to something that when we talk about sexually oriented business and we're going to talk about this being sex, that's a completely different definition than one we would have been operating with a generation ago. Can you talk us through that depersonalization process?
Right, and that's actually why things like laws are not going to be enough. We need to dig deeper and say, how is it that people have, at least some people, have come to prefer a mechanized doll, a robot, to a real person? And it goes back, you can see it happening over time. Look at the hookup culture. The hookup culture rests on the assumption that sex can be purely physical, cut off from the whole person, without any hint of love or commitment. And you talk to young people that today, they know the script all too well. In my new book, Love Thy Body, I included several very heart-wrenching quotes from college students. One of them is named Alicia, and she says, hookups are very scripted. You learn to turn everything off except your body and make yourself emotionally invulnerable. Or another college student that I quote said, the mistake people make is they assume that there's two very distinct elements in a relationship, one emotional and one sexual, and they think there are clean lines between them. So in other words, they treat sex as a strictly physical act, isolated from the rich inner life of the whole person. So what we're seeing is that young people are already being sort of trained in a depersonalized view of sex that treats the body as nothing more than a physical organism driven by physical urges and instincts. And no wonder it's creating a trail of wounded people. No wonder it's creating things like the Me Too movement.
Let's talk about, this kind of jumps ahead, but let's talk about this idea. I mean, let's sort of redeem the conversation and talk about how God intended this to work. Let's talk about the unified body, soul, and spirit, to use some kind of combination of ideas. Talk with us about how God intended this to work.
Right. On the one hand, there's two answers to that. On the one hand, for the individual, you are not meant to function only as a body, disconnecting your mind and your brain and your emotions from what you do with your body. You are meant to be a whole person. Your mind and emotions are meant to be in tune with your body. And in one sense, we could even say that when you have sex outside of the whole person commitment of marriage, when you step outside of that and cut off the sexual element and engage merely sexually, in a way, you're lying with your body. You know, we can speak with our body. We can, you know, everyone knows across the world that a smile means something and a punch in the mouth means something. We communicate with our body. And when we have sex, that is God's ordained way of saying, I belong to you, you belong to me, mind, emotions, heart, and body. So that when you extract sex from that holistic context, you're in a sense lying with your body. You're saying I'm committed to you when you're not. And most of us have had this experience. Sometimes I don't know if you think back to your dating years. You might have held hands with somebody if you didn't really want to. You might have kissed somebody that you didn't really want to, either because they were forcing you to or because you wanted them to think that you cared more than you did. And we sense that we are lying with our bodies. We've all had that experience. And so that, in a sense, what Scripture is saying is that we are lying with our bodies when we have sex extracted from the whole commitment of marriage. We're saying I'm committed to you when we're not.
Nancy, thank you for all of that. And friends, Love Thy Body is a great book to turn to understand not only God's actual, like, real design for all of this, but also how far away from that we have gotten. Nancy, I'm wondering if in the few minutes that we have left, you and I could actually make a transition here and talk about the truth. You have written extensively about the truth. Total Truth and Finding Truth are both really excellent books that I would direct people to. Can you just speak to the moment that we are in right now in America on the subject of truth?
I think that the Kavanaugh hearings have nobody on either side really thinks this is about truth. No one's trying to get at the truth of what happened in Kavanaugh's earlier life. It is strictly a matter of power. And when I was a young person, as a non-Christian, I went to LaBrie, the ministry of Francis Schaeffer. And it's because of my time at LaBrie that I eventually became a Christian. And this was 1971. Back then, Schaeffer was already saying the key issue that Christians need to understand about secular culture today is there's been a shift in the concept of truth. And there's no longer a commitment to truth. And a lot of people didn't really catch it back then. They didn't know what he was talking about. But he kept warning, if a culture loses the concept of truth, all that's left is power. All that's left is sheer power, and there's nothing to protect us from that power. And I sense that that's what's happening in the Kavanaugh hearings, sort of brought it to life in a way that was much more vivid than any we've seen before, that everyone was about, and probably on both sides, this was not a battle to find out what really happened. It was a battle to find out which side was going to win. And I think Schaefer's warning has been borne out, that when you lose the concept of truth, it just becomes a duel of opposing sides over who gets the power.
So let's help the audience redeem that. How can we, in our own lives, in our own conversations today, be people who bear witness to the truth, even in the midst of a culture that doesn't appreciate it?
Yes, that's a good question, because I find in my students, for example, that many of them, even though they're Christian, do not have a strong view of truth. They tend to have a sacred-secular split, where they've been taught that science is really true. That's what's objective. That's what's knowable and testable. And what science can tell us is really what's reliable. And then there's the sacred area where we talk about God and morality and spirituality and so on. And the modern secular view is that that's not really true, because that's not something that you can stick stuff into a test tube and stick under the microscope. And so those things may be meaningful to you, but they're really a matter of personal experience, personal preference, what gives you a reason to get up in the morning. And a lot of Christians, because we've grown up in a secular culture, we've sort of absorbed that notion. And let me give you an example. This really surprised me. I had a master's student. It was in my master's class. I had a master's student in theology. She was in her final semester, so she was very well trained in theology. And she took one of my classes, and she got to the end of the class, and she said, I just realized Christianity is really true. It's not just true in the sense of, if I believe it, it's true for me, but it's actually true of the real world. And I thought, this is very common among Christians. They believe Christianity, but almost like believing it makes it true to them. And they don't understand that Christianity is true, whether you believe it or not. It is objective truth about the structure of reality. And so if we don't understand that, this student said it transformed her life. It transformed the way she talks to her kids, transformed the way she understands the message at church. She said, in fact, after finishing her master's degree in theology, she's coming back and taking one in apologetics so that she can learn more about this life-transforming concept of truth.
Nancy, that's amazing. Friends, let me direct you to two books, Total Truth and Finding Truth, both by Nancy Piercy. You can find her on Twitter at Nancy R. Piercy. You can also find her online at nancypiercy.com. You can obviously find her at Houston Baptist University as well. Nancy, thank you for all the ways you speak truth into our lives. Thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, friends, next up, Tom Schreiner on spiritual gifts, what they are and why they matter. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I have a treat for you this afternoon. On the line with me is Dr. Thomas Schreiner. I'm going to go ahead and give you his Twitter handle. It's at Dr. Tom Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner is a professor of New Testament theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He has written more books than I really probably have time to list off, but commentaries on many of the books in the New Testament. He's also written theologies of Paul, a theology of the New Testament, and a theology of the entire Bible. And he's here with me today to talk specifically about his newest book, Spiritual Gifts. What are they and why they matter? Dr. Schreiner, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks, Carmen. It's great to be with you today.
So I'm curious, to this point, as I've mentioned, you have written commentaries on lots of things and theologies. This book is actually very different. What drew you to this project?
My pastor, John Kimball, asked me if I would speak on spiritual gifts at our men's retreat. And I told him, no, I didn't want to. I wanted to speak on prayer. But then he asked me if I would pray about it. So I said, okay. And I thought, you know, this would be a good topic to work on. And then, so I presented that. I still wasn't going to write a book, but my next door neighbor, who's a colleague of mine, Orrin Martin, he teaches at Boyce and Southern. He kept telling me how to write it up. And so, you know, after about 6 months, he persuaded me. So I did.
So we have been in our home. We've not only been reading your book, but we have been using it in a conversation with our 15-year-old. She heard at Sunday school, you know, they did one Sunday on the passage about gifts in 1 Corinthians. And, you know, what part of the body are you? And so she's been wondering about this. And so Jim and I said to her, well, Eliana, we've got this book. Carmen's got to read it. And in anticipation of a conversation. But as we got into it, we realized it's actually written at a level that you can not only have as a seminary educated adult or as a lay person, but this is actually written at a level that's conversational for older high school students and college students. And so I really want to advocate that people look at this in terms of something that could be really good conversational study material for your small group. Now, as soon as I say that, Dr. Schreiner, everybody's going to want to know, what approach do you take to spiritual gifts? Because they're going to say, we can't talk about that because people in our group view spiritual gifts differently, and that's going to end up in a heated debate. Tell us, give them the out, which is where you start the book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I say is good Christians disagree on whether the gifts still exist today, that we can love one another and affirm one another and support one another and be friends with one another and have different views of spiritual gifts. I even say I could be wrong on this. I'm maybe I need to be corrected.
So I appreciate that. You know, you approach this in a way that opens up conversation. It definitely, it makes clear maybe the way some of us have like overheard that charismatics talk about spiritual gifts, but that's not the world we live in. And so you you talk about that in a really helpful way. And then you actually talk about what the spiritual gifts are. So I would love for you to just let people know, you know, what are the spiritual gifts?
I think spiritual gifts are the abilities that God gives us as believers to minister to one another. And, you know, they range from a gift like helps, which isn't a gift that's talked about a lot, but serving one another, to teaching, and then, you know, more controversial gifts like prophecy and tongues. But there's a myriad of ways by which we build up and help one another as Christians. And I think every one of us as a Christian has such a gift. No, there's no one who's a believer who doesn't have a spiritual gift. The scripture's clear on that.
Well, and some people have multiple gifts. Hey, before we move on to that question, I'm supposed to be telling people that I have copies to give away. So if you're listening to this and you're saying to yourself, I want a copy of that book, you can either text 877-933-2484. Again, that's 877-933-2484. Or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com, and we will get you entered into a drawing for a copy of Spiritual Gifts, What They Are and Why They Matter by Tom Schreiner. All right, Dr. Schreiner, back to this. Some people have multiple spiritual gifts, yes?
No, absolutely.
So
I totally agree.
So we can talk about, like, you know, people talk about their gift mix, or people talk about how to discover their spiritual gifts. Could you give us some indication as to how we might go about discovering or describing or naming our spiritual gifts or the spiritual gifts of others?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, when I was young, which was a long time ago, it was pretty typical in churches to, you know, take little exams or quizzes or tests to try and discern your spiritual gift. And I don't think that's a bad thing to do. But I actually think what I say in the book is the best way to discover your spiritual gift is get involved in your church. As you get involved, your gift will be, and you get involved in other people's lives, love them, serve them, your gift will manifest itself. But you know, I also go on to say, what if you're not totally sure what your gift is? What if you've thought, you've prayed, you've asked other Christians? Here's, I think, another helpful way to think about it. In one way, it doesn't matter. If you're involved in other people's lives, you are exercising your gift, even if you don't know what it is. You probably will find out what it is because other believers will be able to tell you. Sometimes others see us better than we see ourselves.
So I think that's absolutely true. And you have now highlighted what I think for some folks is going to be the new information here, which is the purpose of the gifts is not given for the glory of the individual or for my self-congratulatory moving forward in life. You have described in your answer to that question that the purpose of the gifts is for the building up of the body and the service of others. So can you talk about that? Why is it that God gives us the gift of his Holy Spirit and with that, these spiritual gifts?
Yeah, I think what you said is so important, Carmen. And, you know, it fits with the whole Christian life. We're happiest not when we're staring at ourselves and looking at our own gifts or our own abilities or thinking about how to fulfill ourselves, but we're actually happiest when we're giving our lives to serve and build up others. And that's what the gifts are for, Ephesians 4. It's to build up the body of Christ, to build up and strengthen other Christians, 1 Corinthians 12. And you know, we've all experienced this. We feel joy when we say something encouraging to another person or comfort another person or even, you know, it can be tougher, but I think we sense a purpose in our lives if we say something to challenge another believer to live to the glory of God. I mean, that's what God has called us to do, to invest in others. The happiest people live for the sake of God's glory and for the sake of others.
Friends, I'm talking with Dr. Thomas Schreiner. You can follow him on Twitter at Dr. Tom Schreiner. You can find him at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. We're talking today about his latest book, Spiritual Gifts, What They Are and Why They Matter. I've got some copies. If you'd like to enter the drawing, you can text me at 877-933-2484, or you can always email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Dr. Schreiner, Can we talk for a moment about the reality that some people like fake having a gift? and what do I do if I'm discerning that what's going on is somebody faking it?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, I mean, we always want to be charitable. I would want to know, and I think we should think about why are they faking it? I mean, there's probably some insecurity going on there. They're wanting to feel more important than they feel at that point. So, you know, if we're friends with them, we may gently challenge them regarding faking it and point out what's going on. Because sooner or later, that faking is going to be exposed and they're going to end up being embarrassed. So, If we're a good friend, we'll tell them, I think.
Well, and I think that, you know, in terms of the humility part on my side, like before I think about potentially confronting them, I'm going to dig pretty deeply into the discerning of the spirits portions of scripture and be sure that, you know, I'm actually discerning truth here instead of maybe just being jealous that they appear to be manifesting a gift that I don't have or that I think I do have. And so I think that there are some opportunities for engaging in spiritual discernment and doing that in community with one another. I think that building up the body of Christ, particularly for someone maybe who has a gift of discerning spirits, right? Like that person is really critical in the life of the church today, but we're not really calling forth that gift very often in terms of truth telling.
Yeah. And I think you said something very important. 1 Corinthians 12, No person, Paul says, is to feel superior. No person is to feel inferior. If a person having a different gift from us, maybe a more spectacular gift, doesn't mean they're a better Christian, doesn't mean we're a worse Christian or vice versa. If we think we have the superior gift, there's no room for pride, because the gifts come from God, and the gifts don't translate into spiritual life necessarily. So God reminds us all to be humble. We need him, right? Every hour, as the song goes, we all depend upon him. And yes, we need to be discerning and wise and humble and make sure. I think you said this very well, Carmen. We need to make sure that it isn't just jealousy or a critical spirit that leads us to speak to another. So we want to be cautious and not just leap in and criticize another believer when perhaps there's a problem in our own life.
All right, friends, let me walk off our conversation in this way. On page 16 of Tom Schreiner's book, Spiritual Gifts, What They Are and Why They Matter, you would read this. Gifts aren't designed to help oneself, but are given to serve and build up others. I would define spiritual gifts as gifts of grace granted by the Holy Spirit, which are designed for the edification of the church. If you'd like a copy, I've got a few. You can text me at 877-933-2484 or email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Dr. Schreiner, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Well, Carmen, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Hello, friends. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Let's spend the next few minutes making the connecting point. So I've heard from listeners over the last couple of days, really, I would describe people as in some level of actual like physical pain in terms of what we're going through as a country. I think that we are feeling it. And I don't know about you, but it's expressed in almost every conversation that I'm having. You know, it doesn't matter if I'm talking to my mom or my sister or my colleague or my husband or my friends. And it doesn't even really matter what we are, the subject matter that we thought we were going to be focused on. Somewhere in there, someone says, I can't believe this is happening to us as a country. I can't believe that. And then, you know, somebody sort of expresses how gross they feel. And there's a feelings level to what we are going through that I think is important for us as Christians to take note of. There is a my sister was in D.C. yesterday, and she just described it as a cloud, that there's this dark, that there just feels dark. And so I want to say, hey, we've got some spiritual resources to bring to bear. We are actually people of prayer. We have a connection with the living God. We believe in the redemptive arc of history, which means that, you know, the grace is God's grace and bringing it to bear in human reality. That's the overarching storyline here. Nancy Piercy reminds us that, you know, the truth is the cosmology in which we're living. Like you can't get away from the truth of who God is and that it all belongs to him. It all came from him. It's all going to him. And so when we try to escape from that reality and we try to have our individual truths, or we try to manipulate the truth, or we try to hide the truth, like, right, it doesn't work that way. And so in the connecting point, let me say this. Even in these days, maybe particularly in these days, it is really important that you and I be shiny. Now, not shiny in a prideful way, not, you know, my light's going to outshine your... No, no. more in a this little light of mine sense. Like, I recognize my light is little, but I also recognize that Satan does not have the power to blow it out. And I'm not going to hide it under a basket. And in the midst of these mean times and in these dark days, I'm going to shine. I'm going to be shiny. And that's what I want to call us to. I want to call us to be and do godly good in what we are experiencing as very mean times, very mean-spirited times. So what does it sound like and what does it look like to be people who are godly good? Not goody two-shoes. Nope, not looking for that. Looking for actual people of godly goodness. Loosed in a world that's just frankly pretty mean. What does it sound like? What does it look like? I think it sounds like words of grace spoken in grace to a world in need of grace. I think it looks like acts of mercy done with mercy in a world in need of mercy. I think it sounds like and looks like taking the time to be human, having face-to-face conversations with people, actually, you know, engaging, not just on social media and not just about the media, but actually talking to people, listening to them, saying to someone else, you know, how are you hearing what's going on? How are you processing it? You know that I'm going to be very quick to add to this. If you suspect that they're that you're dealing with a person who has some history of undisclosed and therefore unresolved sexual assault, you know, in much the same way that I encouraged you to enter into conversations in the wake of the revelations related to the Roman Catholic Church and predatory priests, when I said this is the time to turn to people and say to them, did anything like that ever happen to you? And to do it with an openness and a humility and a readiness to be merciful and grieve and help find justice if possible. I think we have those conversations today. It's not inconsequential that that what happened yesterday resulted in something like a fourfold increase in calls to the sexual assault hotline nationally. And there's a reason for that, because people's memories of what happened to them do get jarred when they hear other people bear public testimony and witness to similar experiences. And so in the spirit of, you know, some good may come from this, God working all things together for good, and God taking even what some meant for evil and using it for good, do I expect there to be some good that comes out of all this? Yes, I do. I'm ever hopeful. So this morning, seeking to be a person that was, you know, going to be offering words of grace spoken in grace in a world that is very much in need of grace, and seeking to always be a person who's, you know, ready to have a human conversation, even if my preference would be as an introvert to sort of sit quietly and not be bothered. I want to give a shout out today to a guy named Devin Amar. Devin got up from a table at a coffee shop that I was at this morning. I was with a colleague. We were having a business meeting, and Devin was sitting at the next table. Suffice it to say that the conversation at their table bled over into our booth. And so after the other two people had left, he waited a few minutes, and then he got up and he turned around and looked right at us and apologized. And I smiled broadly and said, oh, you know, we just kind of felt like we were a part of what was going on at your table. And he's like, I know, and that's kind of embarrassing and la la la. And so we struck up a conversation, and I just want to give a shout out to Devin, because I think it takes a lot to sort of recognize what's going on beyond the boundaries of ourselves, let alone our own conversations or the context of our own table at a coffee shop. But then to go on and engage, I mean, I got to tell you, I know I did. I met a brother this morning, and he has this heart, this servant heart, and this desire to be serving people, and this desire to be doing business in such a way that the least among us could be served with the same dignity as those who have all the resources in the world. I mean, I'm just telling you, it was cool. It was one of those just really cool moments. I also want to give a shout out this week to PBS and to Ken Burns and to the people at the Mayo Clinic. If you did not see the PBS documentary Faith, Hope, and Science. You can still go to PBS.org and you can watch it. It will inspire you. It will encourage you. It will be good news to you. I want to give a shout out to the quarterback of the Clemson University football team for coming right out and saying this week, you know what? My identity is football. My identity is not in this university. My identity is in Jesus Christ. I want to give a shout out to the person who stopped to help, who paused to consider, who withheld judgment, who said they were sorry, who offered help, who lended a hand. I want to give a shout out to people this week who were just sort of everyday heroes doing what they do in the midst of regular life, and yet what they do changes the life of another person radically. So one more of those. This popped on my headline this morning from CBS. A life-giving gift got celebrated between the gift giver and the recipient just on Wednesday. So there's a guy facing terminal cancer, and they've basically told him he's, by the way, he's a dad. He's been diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, threatened to take his life. He said, they gave me 6 months to live. I have frequent blood transfusions, and that can't continue indefinitely. And he said, but I never gave up hope. I believe in the goodness of God. And so he's facing terminal cancer, and he gets a phone call that there's been a bone marrow match. And he says, I got a second chance. And now I'm getting a chance to meet the stranger whose bone marrow now lives in me, whose life now lives in me. Think about that for a second. A person with a terminal illness receives a gift of life from another person whose blood now lives in him. Think about that. This is sort of like 101 conversational apologetics. It is really easy to get God into this conversation because that's the gospel. That's the gospel. I am washed in the blood, and the blood that now courses through my body is that of Jesus Christ. This life is now his to live. Okay, so back to the story. These guys met for the first time on Wednesday. It's described in this article at CBS News as a blur of hugs and emotions. And so the question is this: what do you say to a stranger who donated the stem cells that saved your life, whose blood now lives in you? And so this is what Schlinski, who is the patient in this story, the one whose life was saved, he says, oh my God, thank you. He breathlessly hugs Akiva, who is the donor. He says, thank you, thank you. It's so good to meet you. Really, thank you. So Akiva is 25 years old, and he doesn't even remember, you know, it was an inconsequential event that his, you know, mouth was swabbed and he was entered into the bone marrow registry when a family friend was going through cancer. And everybody was encouraged to submit a swab to see if they could find a match. So meanwhile, Howard Schlinski was being diagnosed with terminal cancer. So it's really incredible how science works, right, and how technology works, and how this worldwide network now of bone marrow registry works. That's all really cool. But I want to leave you with this. These two men are believers. Like these are believers, and they talk about this being a local miracle that they hope encourages others, and they talk about this being living proof. Living proof. I want you to think about that. You are living proof of the saving power of Jesus Christ today. So go out there and be shiny. Be living proof. Disprove the meanness of the meantime, and be living proof of the goodness of God. Friends, you can do that by putting flesh on the gospel. Like, go out there and be Jesus-y. Be shiny. Be an ambassador of the kingdom principles of heaven, even in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. All right, friends, that's all the time we've got this week on Connecting Faith. You can join us online at myfaithradio.com. You can join me on my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'd love it if you would share today's show with someone new. Have a great weekend, and God bless. Woo-hoo! Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.